This is WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1963, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. shared his dream with America, progress was being made in school integration. 35 years after Dr. King's death, a new report from Harvard's Civil Rights Project says that schools are sliding back into segregation. Tonight, On Point, the death of the dream of integration. We begin tonight with a reminder of one of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s other causes, the call for peace. Across the country, there were speeches and ceremonies to honor Dr. King and his legacy of civil rights activism. But as David Garrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, reminds us, MLK also worked tirelessly against war. I asked David Garrow what Dr. King would say today about American policy toward Iraq.
If Dr. King himself had had the chance to speak today, whether to President Bush or to anyone else in America in the year 2003, I think there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever what Dr. King would want to talk about today very forcefully, very strongly, is how Americans ought to oppose any military initiative against Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Dr. King, throughout his lifetime, was not only utterly committed to nonviolence, Dr. King was also a very outspoken critic of American militarism abroad. In the latter few years of his life, when he was attacking America's conduct of the Vietnam War, Dr. King's criticisms were not at all popular, not popular even among black Americans. And I think it's safe to say that were he still with us today at age 74, much of what he would have to say about Iraq, about welfare policies in the United States, wouldn't prove terribly popular with Americans today.
Mm-hmm. And yet he was a student, if I'm not mistaken, at least of the writings of Reinhold Niebuhr. And in Niebuhr, you don't get a kind of blanket pacifism. Was Dr. King a pacifist, or did he believe in just war or a kind of Niebuhrian gradualism, meliorism about war?
It's hard to give a completely certain answer, Jack, because on the one hand, Dr. King on any number of occasions did describe himself as a pacifist, even on several occasions when racist or Nazi wacko young men slugged him. Mm-hmm. He literally turned the other cheek. Mm-hmm. Yet on at least one occasion, Dr. King passingly said, well, yes, I would have fought against Hitler.
Now, did he really think that that could work for nations as well, nonviolence?
Yes, that he believed just as strongly, just as totally, as he believed in nonviolence as a domestic protest tactic.
With what realism do you think? I mean, what, for example, India today have long since forgotten the teachings of Gandhi, although they were that India should reflect them.
Dr. King was utterly opposed to nuclear weapons very early on, also announced his opposition to capital punishment back in the late 1950s. For King, it was less a question of calculation of means and ends than it was of an ethical or philosophical need to bear witness. When he first started speaking out against the Vietnam War in 1965, and then when he really attacked the war full volume in 1967, criticism of the war at that time was still pretty much a fringe activity. I think many Americans may think that opposition to the Vietnam War was a well-respected position, as indeed it became several years later during the Nixon presidency. But for King to attack Lyndon Johnson, who even in 1967 was thought quite understandably to have done more for black America than any other president, was also seen as suspect that King was a, quote, civil rights leader who was speaking out on an issue outside his one special expertise.
It cost him, as I remember. Lyndon Johnson was not friendly to him afterwards, and that could really have hurt possibly his movement.
It hurt Dr. King and hurt SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his organization, in many ways. Both the NAACP and the National Urban League basically shied away from in any way defending Dr. King on that. Mm-hmm. And even many liberal Democratic members of Congress basically distanced themselves or criticized Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
Only in the last few months of Dr. King's life, when both Senator Eugene McCarthy and then Senator Bobby Kennedy stepped forward to challenge President Johnson on the war, did things begin to shift.
Mm-hmm. You also, and just briefly, point out that Dr. King was a critic of capitalism, or at least of one of its major effects, inequality.
Dr. King was very outspoken, even more so in private than in public, about economic inequality. He thought of himself as a socialist even when he was in graduate school, and he said as much to his staff in private in 1967. And I think it's important for people nowadays to keep in mind, too, that not only if King were here today would he be attacking President Bush regarding Iraq. Had Dr. King been here the last few years, he would have spoken out very, very strongly against President Clinton's welfare reform policies. So whether it's domestic issues or international issues, much of what Dr. King represented in the mid and late 1960s was not just radical then, it would still be radical and a little bit outside the mainstream even today.
So when he said, "I have a dream," it wasn't merely, it wasn't just of black and white amity and friendship and interracial growth. It was also a dream of peace and of justice.
Exactly, especially after he was awarded the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. King increasingly felt a sense of obligation to speak out on other issues as well, wholly irrespective of whether what he had to say was going to help his popularity or not. Maybe what's most important and impressive about Dr. King of all was that this was a man who very consciously said what he believed without looking at any polls or focus groups or calculating how it would play to his own personal advantage.
Thank you so much, David Garrow.
Certainly, Jack.
David Garrow is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and professor at Emory University. He spoke with us earlier from Atlanta. After years of becoming a multiracial society, we may now be living in the age of resegregation. The trend springs from white flight, growing numbers of minority students, and conservative court decisions against integration. Whites are now the most segregated group, the average attending a school with an 80% white student body. Listeners, do you live a segregated life? Do you want to? Do your children go to integrated schools? 35 years after Dr. King's death, studies show that segregation is back. Did it ever really leave? Why are we still a divided nation? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Gary Orfield, co-founder of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University and co-author of a new and rather shocking report, new report on segregation. Gary Orfield, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Give us a sort of snapshot of the state of sort of metric of segregation in three different times. Let's begin with 1948. What was the state of segregation in America then?
Well, there was absolute segregation in 17 states that had state laws that required it, and the nation's capital, of course. And there was close to it in most of the rest of the country. There was almost every single northern city that's ever been examined in a federal court has been found during that period to have been discriminating blatantly in housing and in schools. So we had very little integration of any sort.
And you had a kind of official segregation and de jure.
Of course, Plessy versus Ferguson was still the law of the land until 1954, so it was perfectly legal to segregate.
That was Strom Thurmond's America. 1980, what was the state of segregation?
Well, by 1980, and actually by 1970, we had made a huge breakthrough in the South. The southern states and the border states, the six states outside the old Confederacy that had legalized segregation, had moved to be more integrated probably than any place in the United States had ever been, and much more integrated than the North. And they've really been more integrated ever since that time.
These were the Southern schools.
The Southern schools. They were the places where the law was actually enforced, particularly during the Johnson administration, during the time of the Warren Court, and into the early 1970s.
And then 2003. What is the state of segregation today?
In 2000,
as against 19, late 7.
Well, what happens was we continued to become more integrated in our schools for blacks and whites through the late 1980s, in spite of the Reagan administration's attacks and everything else. The courts really didn't change the laws during that period. And there was a lot of improvement in terms of suburbanization of minorities and people moving outside the ghetto boundaries and so forth. So our schools actually became more and more integrated up through 1988. Of course, we never did much to integrate the Northeast, which was the most segregated part of the country. But in the southern states particularly, we made large progress. And in some states, we almost eliminated segregation completely. Some states like Kentucky and Delaware, for example, where the largest metropolitan areas were desegregated across city and suburban boundary lines. This began to go backwards in the 90s. There were three Supreme Court decisions that authorized a return to segregated neighborhood schools and really put pressure on courts to terminate desegregation orders. And we saw a very rapid change, particularly in the South, which has had the most substantial resegregation. It's now nowhere near as bad as it was in 1954. People who say that are just dead wrong. There is a developing pattern of extreme segregation. About one-sixth of black students in the country are now in what we call apartheid schools, which are 0 to 1% white. About one-ninth of Latino students.
And what would that have been in, say, 1988?
It would have been substantially lower. I can't give you the exact figure.
So we're going backwards.
We're going backwards. And for Latino students, we never really went forwards. Latinos are now our largest minority, and they're even more segregated than African Americans by race and poverty and now increasingly by language as well.
You mentioned political and legal environment around this. What are the other causes of resegregation?
Well, we have fewer whites and more minorities in the country, as everyone probably realizes. During the period from 1968 to the present, we've had several hundred percent growth of Latino students, a significant growth of African Americans, and then a shrinkage, about a fifth less whites in our public school population. And the private schools haven't shown any significant gain in whites either. So the whites just weren't born. And our population is being driven by international immigration. It's a very large immigration that's going on into the United States now. And this is the first major wave of immigration that's overwhelmingly non-white coming into the country.
So partly it's just this demographic change.
Partly it's demographic. And then partly it's the spread of housing segregation to encompass larger and larger areas in our central cities. Our central city school districts have about a quarter of the minority students in the country and only about 2% of the whites. So you can't integrate within those boundaries, but the Supreme Court drew a line between the city and the suburbs, a legal line back in 1974 in a 5-4 decision that really prevented lasting desegregation in many of our metropolitan areas.
And in vital respects, we live in the age of William Rehnquist in these matters, don't we?
We do. And William Rehnquist, as a clerk on the Supreme Court at the time of the Brown decision, wrote a memorandum suggesting that Plessy should be sustained.
Separate but equal. We're talking about segregation this hour. It apparently is back in America. What are your thoughts about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the resegregation of American schools, American neighborhoods this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Gary Orfield, who's the co-author of the latest study of civil rights from the Harvard Project on Civil Rights. And also joining us now is Tricia Rose, professor of American Studies at the University of Southern California at Santa Cruz. Tricia Rose, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
You've now read Gary Orfield's report about resegregation. What is your reaction to it?
Well, I have read it. I'm very grateful that he and the project have worked together to pull this off. It's an incredibly important study. It's the kind of information that we very rarely get. So much of the information that we get about what's going on in American culture and society is really quite mass-mediated. And this kind of nuts-and-bolts analysis of a slow slide toward resegregation is precisely what we need to address the kinds of situations we're dealing with now.
Slow slide to resegregation. Does that imply that there was an era of integration? If there was, I was sort of aware of it. I'm glad to hear that there was progress, but at least in social life and in just sort of workplaces and so on, I at least haven't seen it.
Well, you know, what I'm saying is that there were clearly moments in which higher levels of integration were systematically enabled. Mm-hmm. Policies that have been dismantled by the Reagan administration and other such administrations have made those kinds of gains less and less likely. And so what's happening when I say a slide toward resegregation, mm-hmm. it's not to say that there was ever integration
sure.
in full, but to say that there was, in a sense, a vision of the possibility of policies that enabled integration, a proactive set of policies. I mean, clearly what this study is showing that when efforts to create integration are not sustained and implemented, we move toward the kinds of, in a sense, a national unconscious as well as an active, what I consider to be a conservative agenda, to sustain various kinds of segregation.
Mm. You know, Jack, we really did make a lot of progress, and people don't realize it, especially people in the Northeast, because they didn't see very much of it. The really dramatic progress was in the South. Mm. And there were a number of areas in the South which had countywide school districts all over Florida and much of North Carolina, some parts of South Carolina and other places where there were really no segregated schools for 25 or 30 years, where the entire metropolitan area had common schools in a deep sense. And some of those areas really cherished that experience. And down in Charlotte, for example, the voters voted to maintain it even after the court didn't require it anymore. And in a terribly ironic situation, their school board went into federal court and said they hadn't done enough. They hadn't really made the schools completely fair. They wanted to continue to work on it. They even proved that they even submitted evidence about their own shortcomings. And a federal judge who had once been an anti-busing leader appointed by President Reagan to be a federal judge wouldn't allow them to continue it, forbade it, and now they're in the process of rapid resegregation. It's kind of a historic tragedy. Here in Boston, you know, with Boston Latin School, they were setting aside spaces for Black and Latino children in an 80% minority school district in the best school that really is connected to the great colleges of the country, the oldest school in the country, and a federal judge forbade that. Even after the Boston School Committee wanted to do it, the most recalcitrant organization in the entire country in many ways in terms of the desegregation process wanted to continue that, and they were forbidden to by a federal court. This just shows you the extremely strange and dangerous change in the role of the federal courts in this whole process.
And this is part and parcel, let's be candid, of the Southern strategy of the Republican Party. They haven't been running for segregation, but they have been running against integration. Isn't that a fair statement?
That's completely fair. It's all, you can read it in all of the campaign memoirs of President Nixon's campaign. They decided how to get the votes. They went after them. If you read the papers of Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, he's always recounting how Nixon would send memos. Let's stir up the busing issue. Let's stir up the suburban housing issue. We can get white votes in Michigan. We can get them in Alabama. It was a very calculated plan.
Tricia Rose?
Yes. Yeah, you know, what this really indicates is an important shift in political strategy over the past 15 years or so, in which a sort of seemingly collective language of diversity, of collectivity, is deployed on the surface. Mm-hmm. But underneath that surface, a strategy of continued segregation and various kinds of racism are actually being enabled. You know, many, many years ago, those policies and the languages were overlapping. Mm-hmm. Now there's quite a big gap. And so there's people, I think, frequently, unless they follow all of these politics very closely, may be led to believe that there is, in fact, an investment in a collective source and kind of racial equality in this nation on all camps from all sides in the mainstream political spectrum. And that simply isn't the case.
Mm. In the black community, among black thinkers, there's been a kind of double clutch over the years about integration, hasn't there? I mean, the feeling that was that integration implied that blacks needed whites to rise. And has that sort of intellectual argument and unease with the notion of integration as something that will improve the situation of blacks, has that contributed at all to a kind of diminution in support for integration among black intellectuals?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that there's an overall decline in the faith and the possibility of something that was once called integration because of the kind of steadfast retrograde responses. This kind of, you know, resegregation and this systematic mm-hmm. dismantling of various policies, you know, is part of what I would consider to be a post-civil rights form of discontent and a sense of despair. You know, there's really not much you can do if after, you know, 30 years of social protest, people still can't see the value of dismantling the legacy of apartheid in this country. So, you know, people lose a certain level of faith and hope when these policies continue to resurface. On the other hand, many blacks feel that black institutions were dismantled with integration and that now that there's resegregation, there are no longer the kinds of stable, sustaining black institutions to help the communities that were there previously. So, you know, one of the things we have to figure out how to deal with in this situation is to have a collective sense for not just integration for moving blacks into white schools, et cetera, but for sharing and having a common vision for schools, for housing, for cities, for jobs, and at the same time recognize that until we actually have a society in which racism is not an ongoing systematic process, mm-hmm. that black institutions have to be important at the same time.
Sure. Gary Orfield, picking up on this point, you know, the reasoning of the Brown decision, based on Kenneth Clark's social science research, has come under some attention and scrutiny and criticism over the years, that there was an overstatement of the perhaps an overstatement of the harms of segregation. I'm boiling it down. But what are the harms of segregation? Quite apart from the social science issues, what does the evidence say?
I want to answer that, but first I want to quote something Dr. King said about this issue, which I think is really important and really helps illuminate the discussion. Desegregation, he said, simply removes those legal and social prohibitions. Integration is creative, and it is more profound and far-reaching. It's the positive acceptance of desegregation and the welcome participation of, he said, Negroes into the total range of human activities. The idea of integration and the idea of desegregation are different. One is letting somebody from the outside into white society. The other is transforming the society into a truly multiracial society of mutual respect. And that's what Dr. King was talking about, and that's really what integrationists are after. It's not assimilation, it's transformation. And I think that that's very important. Now, the harms of segregation that were talked about in the Brown decision were not just what Kenneth Clark had to say about the dolls. There were a whole lot of social scientists, Gunnar Myrdal and many others, cited by the Supreme Court. And they're basically the harms of a racially polarized society where race is connected to many forms of inequality. Our study shows that in 9 out of 10 segregated neighborhood black or Latino schools, there's concentrated poverty. Now, with concentrated poverty, you get children that are less prepared. You get children that move all the time because they can't afford housing. You get children who come in with untreated serious health problems. You get children who don't speak English. Very important thing is that in high-poverty schools, you get teachers without experience, and the teachers leave as fast as they can transfer to someplace else. And we've shown in a study that we commissioned earlier this year that in Georgia, for example, as resegregation is going on, the white teachers are leaving. And the testing process in the teaching profession is screening out more and more potential black and Latino teachers. So we're getting white teachers who don't want to stay in the resegregating schools, and we're putting more and more pressure on those schools, and more of the teachers are leaving in response. It's a very destructive cycle. Basically, other things that are important, the peer group. Mm-hmm. Peer group is extremely important in terms of achievement, and it's different. Since in high poverty schools, the peer group's less prepared and they're less connected with college. Their families have a lot less resources. The families are weaker politically. There's a much higher graduation rate in middle class schools. So many things are connected with segregation.
So separate and flagrantly unequal education is what we have in many of these schools.
Yes, a lot of people say there's nothing magic about sitting next to a white child, which is absolutely true. But there is something that's very much more advantageous to a young person to grow up in a middle class school than in a high poverty school that's overwhelmed with social crisis.
Sure. Let's take a call. Hillary is calling from Boston, Mass. Welcome. Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you for
how
calling.
Are you?
We're fine. Thank you for calling On Point.
Thank you. You actually kind of hit some of my points that I wanted to make. This issue is really important to me for many reasons. I've moved to Boston about 13 years ago from rural upstate New York.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, in the rural environment, I had more contact with different racial groups than I do here in Boston. And I was really surprised and shocked to find that the segregation in Boston, not only is it by racial lines, but it's in many ways by economic lines. And I was surprised to find that, and I kind of joke around, you meet people from any one town in Boston, and you can identify that town. You can identify it as white collar, blue collar, working class, the whole bit. And it's always, it's amazingly segregated in many ways. And I kind of wonder, you know, how much economics truly plays a role in what we now have as a racial divide as well.
Mm-hmm. Good question, Hillary. Thank you. Gary Orfield?
Well, economics is very important. We are segregated both by race and social class within race. There's a high level of segregation between middle class and poor blacks or Latinos. And we are having a huge migration of middle class minorities out of cities into suburbs now, unfortunately into resegregating suburbs in many cases. But this is one of the problems about restoring those good schools that people remember from a few places in the segregated past. The middle class that was confined to those ghettos is no longer confined. They're gone. So you just get a much more concentrated poverty when you return to neighborhood schools. We have housing patterns that sort people out by social class in a very destructive way, I think, for the future of our communities. And it means that the people who are running our society are growing up in a very privileged situation to which they think they're entitled. They're very segregated. They're isolated. They're not being prepared for a society that will be half non-white in the future. And they tend to blame the problems of other people on the inferiority of their culture rather than the inequality of their opportunities.
Indeed, that's a whole apologetics of conservatism.
Exactly.
The victim is responsible. The culture is responsible. This has nothing to do with American history. It has nothing to do with discrimination. It has nothing to do with economics. You're the problem.
There's a profound denial that there's any continuing effect of the history of racial discrimination in the society. Mm. It is a basic reality in the arguments.
Tricia Rose?
Absolutely right. Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's in fact that denial that I think allows this discrepancy to go on. And the discrepancy I'm referring to is a very easy, common public conversation about, of course, we're all for equal opportunity. Of course, we want everyone to have a fair chance. And I would never suggest otherwise. And a series of policies that are either actively pursued or passively ignored that make that larger sense of equality impossible. And it's that gap that is explained by this denial. And I think, you know, to go back to this other question of the caller's point about meaningful day-to-day contact, I mean, it's without meaningful day-to-day contact among different groups of people from different races, different classes, you are not going to be able to learn how to problem solve together. You're not going to be able to learn how different groups of people, based on their histories, based on their ethnicities, religion, races, how they have different experiences in the world. And you develop a kind of empathy, a compassion for groups of people when you see them as part of your community. If parents and students and teachers are working together to solve common learning problems and common resource problems, which of course can happen across within class as well, as well as across, you know, then you learn a sense, hey, these are individual people who also belong to a group and they have experiences that are similar and different from me. Mm-hmm. And now we have the capacity for a democratic community.
I'd just like to add something that in this depressing discussion that's really very encouraging, I think, for anybody. We've been studying high school students, high school juniors in cities around the country, and students in graduate schools, in law schools and medical schools, to find out what the effect of being in diverse classes is. And every place we look, white students, black students, Latino students, Asian students, even foreign students in these law schools say it is a powerful effect on them when they have the chance to have exchanges in and out of class with students of other racial and ethnic backgrounds. They report that they learn how to understand each other. They learn how to talk to each other about hard issues. They learn how to live together. They learn how to work together across racial lines. They say they'll be comfortable as adults working in interracial settings under supervisors of other races. They report that they feel confident that they've solved issues that a lot of us had to struggle with when we were growing up. And I find it very encouraging and very depressing that nobody's asking them or thinking about what they've learned as we go through this resegregation process.
In fact, there's been some research on METCO students here in Boston who are students from the inner city who've been bused, some of them getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get to these distant, affluent white high schools. And that has been a remarkable success for the people in the program, has it not?
Yes. We surveyed all their parents several years ago and found that their parents really weren't going to sit next to whites. They were going for a better education, and they're making huge sacrifices to do it, and they believed that they were winning. And the overwhelming majority of those students were planning to go to four-year colleges, even though they came out of a random cross-section of different kinds of economic levels in Boston, the black community. Now, Susan Eaton wrote a wonderful book called The Other Boston Busing Story, which tells about the life experiences followed over many years of what happened to these students and why the great majority of them want to send their own children on the same program a generation later.
And a program that, as I know from my own experience, and just to reiterate, because it's worth saying, kids really had, and parents really had to sacrifice early morning, late at night, all sorts of problems with extracurricular activities, and facing it out for 4 years, bravely, and many of these kids movingly. We're talking about segregation this hour, the dark blot on America. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the resegregation of America. Do you live a segregated life? Do your children attend segregated schools? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Gary Orfield, co-author of a new report on state of segregation from Harvard, and Tricia Rose, a sociologist at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Peter is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling On Point.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, thanks. I wanted to thank you, Jack, and Dr. Orfield and Dr. Rose. This is a wonderful discussion. I've always been impressed by Dr. Orfield's work ethic and the huge number of projects that he seems to be able to carry off. I was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago when you were there, Dr. Orfield, and I dropped out of one of your housing policy classes after the first week because of the huge amount of reading and writing and number of projects and papers that were due in that class.
It would have been good for your soul.
Yes. I just had to admit defeat at that point, but I tip my hat to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
I guess I wanted to ask if because so many of the political arguments in favor of resegregation seem to come from sort of this simplistic conservative philosophy of individualism and that if we want to have a colorblind society, then we shouldn't even pay attention to issues of segregation, and that it is just the fault of every individual, regardless of their situation.
Sharpen that into a question for us, would you, Peter?
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Let's see. What do you see as a possibility for reversing this legal trend, since those seem to be the legal arguments that are being made as well?
Peter, thank you. Gary?
Thank you very much.
Well, right now we're kind of confronting a stacked deck in the courts because there are judges that were chosen to have very narrow social understandings and screened by the Federalist Society and other politically oriented groups that have a vision of a different constitution and are kind of enacting that vision into law by the court's decisions. I think that the fights over who goes on the courts this year in the Congress are going to be very, very important. What happens in the next presidential election will be extremely important. I think that if these kinds of appointments are made and the Supreme Court is consolidated in this direction, we're looking at a situation where there's going to be almost no help and the courts will be a major obstacle to the adaptation of the country to the demographic change that it's going through. It'll be like the crisis with the Supreme Court and the economic change of the country in the early 20th century that had to be resolved during the Roosevelt administration. And that would be a huge tragedy for the country. This year, we've got the Michigan case, which will determine whether or not we can continue affirmative action in higher education. And it all depends on whether at least one of the very conservative justices can be given the understanding about the historic roots of the problem and the benefits and the necessity of, if we're going to eventually have free choice and have a situation where all individuals really do have unfettered choices, we have to overcome the continuing harm of segregation and enable people to be in a situation where they can have those choices. And we're very far from that now.
Tricia Rose?
Yes. I think what's very important for us to keep in mind is that, you know, all of these political circumstances, the courts, how they're being stacked, you know, are circumstances, particularly when it comes to race, that has a very long history. So what we have to decide is how we're going to build a new and multiracial social movement that can basically respond to these decisions, these containing and ultimately racist decisions, to respond to them in ways that are going to work against them and overcome what they've been doing. I mean, what did King and the rest of the civil rights movement have to deal with? I mean, certainly they had stacked courts as well. Mm-hmm. So the question is really going to be how we develop a language. And at this moment, I wanted to turn to something I think that we have to be a little more focused on, and that is not just a language of, you know, integration in the terms that the incredible Martin Luther King devised it, but also understanding that young people are living in a different moment and that they're not necessarily in touch with the language of the civil rights movement in the way that people over 40 might be. And I think it's important that we think about new ways to language what is clearly an ongoing set of policies, you know, not unlike what I consider to be the conservative movement's ability to take up the language of civil rights, the language of colorblindness, and work it against movements for social justice.
Yeah.
We need to think of new languages that might be able to consolidate what is in fact going on, educate people, because I think what's so amazing about this study, which I did have an opportunity to read, you know, is just how much this kind of information is unavailable to us in everyday life. And also the ways in which colorblindness is now being used as a way to mask what is the ongoing privilege of whiteness. And that's what another category we need to add to this conversation on integration and on race, you know, is the privilege of whiteness that is trying to be dismantled for equity for all.
Amen. And, of course, Gary Orfield in the 1960s, the black church generated that language, the language of justice. It's still there, but you know the Bush administration says that it's worried in the lot business about the white suburban woman. They didn't want that woman to think they were racist. What about that white suburban woman? What does she need to understand?
Well, she needs to understand that there are racial consequences of our elections that are very serious. The reason that the 9/10 of African Americans have voted against the Republican Party in the last couple of generations is that they believe it's actively hostile, that it's committed to dismantling their rights. That's the only reason any major group of citizens would vote in that kind of extraordinary majority. Now we've been told that there's going to be a compassionate conservatism. We were told there were going to be 100 points of light. There's a little slogan in each campaign that says, you don't have to worry about us. We're really kind. We really wouldn't do anything bad. But then they go into office and they appoint really bitter opponents of civil rights to run all the civil rights agencies. And then people are surprised that there are reversals in policy. And they're surprised when their Trent Lott speaks out. It's a very deep problem that people kind of don't focus on and that they need to focus on because it's a consequential choice for our country.
Indeed. Thank you, Gary Orfield. Gary Orfield is the co-author of the latest Harvard report on the project of civil rights. And thank you, Tricia Rose. Tricia Rose is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Mahalia Jackson's Precious Lord and its significance as we observe the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. This is On Point. Tonight with Mahalia Jackson singing Take My Hand, Precious Lord. Many of Martin Luther King's closest friends said that her rendering of the song was his favorite. University of South Carolina professor Bobby Donaldson also loves Precious Lord and uses it in lectures about Dr. King. The song captures gospel music's power to transform the heavy burdens of life into the food of hope, just as the good Dr. King preached.
Precious Lord is a prayer, and when you think about the context out of which Dorsey wrote it, it makes sense. I mean, Precious Lord was written in probably the worst moment of his life, sort of written out of response to grief after the death of his wife and newborn son, and it's really a plea for this sort of transcendent spirit. And by 1932, Precious Lord becomes his signature song, and he begins to scout for talented musicians who would demonstrate the song, and that's what he called them, demonstrators. And one of the most talented of those demonstrators was young Mahalia Jackson, that he picked and sort of trained and nurtured. And he thought she was probably the best person to demonstrate to street front congregations and to storefront congregations and to working class families really the power of his music. She was reared early in what was called the Sanctified Church. And when you see Mahalia or hear Mahalia, she brings that Sanctified Church tradition to traditional gospel. And Dorsey, who comes out of that same experience, was looking for someone who could bridge the secular and secular, or who could bridge sort of the blues medium with traditional hymns. And Mahalia, when you listen to her power and her performance, she was probably the most equipped to do that.
I am tired
overcome was at the anthem of the movement. For King, this song really registered. His father, who was called Daddy King, was asked about Martin's, or what sort of inspired him. And King's father always said it was the Baptist church, and said King always had a deep love for the church and for its music. And apparently, King himself was a great singer. And there were occasions in some literature where King and Mahalia performed together, often in very private settings. And so I think early on, the song really appealed to him. And when you listen to it, as I said earlier, if the song amounts to a prayer, I think it shows the anxiety, the anguish that King often experienced as a leader that most people would not sort of think about, sort of the real pressures that came with the job as being the signature spokesperson for the movement.
Through the night, take my hand, pray.
At the March on Washington on August 27, 1963, there is this lore, I'm not sure how true it is, that midway during the speech, King gives really a traditional speech that he's always given at other rallies and gatherings. And apparently it is Mahalia who says, "Martin, tell him about the dream." And apparently she, a week or two before, had heard the "I Have a Dream" speech in Detroit at a church pastored by C.L. Franklin, who is the father of Aretha Franklin, and some say that it was Mahalia who urged King to make this part of his speech, which, of course, is his most famous speech.
Precious Lord, linger near.
The irony of all of this is that on April the 4th, the evening of King's assassination, one of the last conversations he holds is with a man named Ben Branch. And Ben Branch was a jazz saxophonist who was to perform that evening at the rally in Memphis. And Ben Branch was in a conversation with Jesse Jackson in the parking lot of the Lorraine Motel. And King apparently leans over the balcony and asks Branch to play Precious Lord and to play it real pretty at the rally. And according to many people, including Jesse Jackson, those are the last words they remember King saying. And Mahalia Jackson heard that. And several days later at the funeral, she indeed performs Precious Lord.
On the river, ooh, we'll stand.
Someone asked Mahalia Jackson, "Why do you spend all your time singing gospel, particularly in an era of Sammy Davis Jr. and Nat King Cole and others?" And her response, and this is a direct quote, "When you sing gospel, you have a feeling that there's a cure for what's wrong." And so I think for King, this song, though it is a very painful song, I think it's also a very confident song. I think both King and Jackson were of the belief that God was a God of the disfranchised and God was a God of the oppressed. So they sing this song knowing full well that the prayer will be answered or would be answered. And I think that's the sort of love that King developed with these particular lyrics.
Take my hand, precious Lord, and
Bobby Donaldson is Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of South Carolina. He is a former researcher at the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Lord,
This is WB.